Hello. Okay. Reminds me of Mongolia. We went to Mongolia, we taught Badbo's a translator. One of the finest in the world, actually. Very shy. So I should embarrass him. We did the Heart Sutra to prevent autism.
That's it. Yeah.
The first night, 5-night TV show. And all the lights went out in the city for an hour and a half. Anyway. You okay? Try this one.
It's going again.
Okay. At this part, this is sort of a fun class. This class is supposed to take like 2 months, 2.5 months. We're doing it 4 days. And that's just due to time constraints. But anyway, I thought in the middle it's nice to have like a fun class. And it comes from a part in the sutra when Subhuti is sitting there kind of freaking out. He's starting to get everything, you know. And he's like freaking out and he's starting to understand everything and he's getting really excited. And then he stops for a moment and he says to Lord Buddha, you know, how's anybody going to get this later on? You know, like, you're sitting here, you're Lord Buddha, you're explaining it to us, and we can understand it. But, you know, after you're not around anymore, or after a few hundred years, or you know, as your teachings go on to the world, how's anybody going to get all this? You know, because it's so strange. And people are going to read your sutra and misunderstand it, and you know, how is it possible in the future, like, in the, he says the last of the 500, which is a code word for something, and I'll explain to you. But he says, in the last days of your teaching on this planet, how's anybody ever going to understand this thing, you know? And then Lord Buddha gets almost angry, and he says, don't talk like that. Don't ask this question, you know? It's true that things will get bad, and it's true that my teaching itself will die out in the world. But even in the final days, there will be these holy great beings like bodhisattvas who really do understand what's going on and who have seen emptiness directly. And they will show up in weird places of the world and continue to teach this thing perfectly, very well. You know, and he says, so don't ask that question. You know, stop asking questions like that. You know, and then he gets very emotional. This brings up the question of how long will Buddhist teachings stay in the world? And I thought it'd be nice to do a class about that. And I personally, one of the reasons I became a Buddhist was because of the teachings on impermanence. I mean, the first book I ever read, which is a very bad translation that I was supposed to read in college, right? Sounded great to me then. And it was talking about the Buddhist teachings on that nothing lasts and everything's impermanent, you know? And I had troubles like my parents died, my brother died, and even worse than that, my high school girlfriends used to go away, or the relationship used to fall apart. And I was like struck, I was struck by how even the most beautiful things can just suddenly go through this curve and then degenerate and then fall apart, you know? And it struck me that every relationship I ever had, or everything I possessed, or every job I ever had, there's this peak, you know? It starts out, you're really excited to get the job, you're fighting for the job, you know, they give you anything, you don't care, you take it, and then you go up, 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 and then you reach this plateau, and then it goes down, you know what I mean? And then after a while, you're dissatisfied, you don't like the job, you wish you never took this job, you can't believe they gave you this job, you know, and everything goes like this, you know, everything's impermanent. Everything wears out. Actually, what's not happening is not that you're a bad person or your ex-girlfriend or boyfriend is a bad person. The karma to meet them, the karma to have a sweet relationship, you know, the karma to be really tight, wears out. Okay, it's not you're a bad person or they're a bad person. All karmas wear out if you don't collect them the right way. So they're just wearing out. It's not you, it's not them, it's karma, you know, and then you really do start to see them as having, you know, this beautiful person suddenly has a fault, and then they have 2 faults, and then there's 3 things wrong with them, and then there's 5 things wrong with them, and then you'd like nothing better than to not be in a room with them. And it's this peak, and it's not you and it's not them, it's the karma to have this beauty wears out, and all the karmas wear out. All normal karmas that are not collected with the understanding of emptiness wear out. And then you they must change. And it's not like you're changing or you're not a good person or they're, you didn't understand something about them and now you understand it. It's that you're going from pen to chewable thing. You know, your perceptions are changing. Okay? And it's not done, okay? They're empty, okay? They're just a blank screen and you're projecting your world on them. Okay? And it's not you really because you're under the mercy of your old karmas. By the way, it's important to say this is not a choice. Old karmas are in your karmic pockets, your subconscious, they're bhaksats, the seeds of them are staying there. And then they start to ripen, and you don't have any choice. You can't say, oh, you know, this is just a perception. I'll think of this as a Kit Kat chocolate bar, you know. Who knows, you know, it's about the right shape, you know, and it doesn't work like that. You're at the mercy of your own karmas. And it's really important when you teach this to other people, which we're going to talk about, that you don't try to imply that it's just an attitude problem. You know what I mean? Oh, be happy. Try to be positive. You know, dialogue is a chance to, you know, investigate life or something. You know what I mean? it's not like that. I mean, it's unpleasant. You know, maybe I could have learned the same thing through a pleasant way. That would have been better. You see what I mean? It's that you're at the mercy of your own karma. You don't have a choice. Things are your projections, but you can't change it. Okay, you have to change your karma. And then work it out that way, okay? So, the reason I brought up all this stuff about impermanence was that one of the things that impressed me most about Buddhism when I started Buddhism was that the founder of the religion, you know, like Lord Buddha, is predicting the end of his religion, you know, while he's starting his religion, you know, and I thought this is so intelligent, you know, this is a great man. This man understands impermanence so well that even about this own, you know, people who have successful organizations, dharma or business or government or anything else, there's always this fatal error. They always think it's going to last forever. They always believe that they're going to be around forever, their thing's going to be successful forever. And here, to me, a being who in the opening days of his teaching says, oh, and by the way, this organization is going to go bankrupt in X number of years. You know, my own teaching is going to die out in the world. And that's how bad impermanence is, you know. I was just very impressed by that, okay. Now, there's always debates about how long is Buddhism going to last in the world. How do we know how long it's going to last? And where are we now? Okay, so I'm going to give you... Chenro Dabashiri wrote a book about, he wrote a book about Abhidharma, and in there he covers some of the ideas. So I'm just going to give you a few examples from scripture about how long the Buddha's Dharma is supposed to hang around. And then, the reason I want to get into it is that there's always these Dharma rumors, you know, there's rumors that the Tibetans and the Indians in America used to be one people, and the Dharma's going to spread to the Navajo, and all this stuff, and things like that. And I used to get impatient with these kind of New Agey Buddhism things, you know, and I didn't like it. Then I'm reading Chöni Dorje Shinshu's treatise on it, and then suddenly he starts to talk about Dharma moving to the Western countries. And he starts to describe it from sutra, and he quotes sutras, and I went and looked it up in the sutras, and it's true. And I thought that's really cool, so I thought we should talk about that too. All right? But we'll start out with how long is the Dharma going to last in the world? Okay. So, chö. First thing you have to understand what the word dharma means, okay? This is dharma. In Tibetan, it's chö. In Sanskrit, dharma. Something like dharma. And dharma means, it comes from a root called dharma, You can say dur, okay? And dur means to hold something. Okay, dur means to grasp to something or to hold to something, okay? And then the word dharma is derived from dur. And what it means is any existing thing. Okay, rangin lo jinbe na chur, that's the definition in the monastery, in the debate ground, okay? Rangin lo jinbe na chur means because it dur or holds its own nature, because it has some nature, it is a dharma. Okay, and they're playing on the word dur. You see, so dharma's old meaning was anything that's a thing. Anything that exists is called dharma. Okay? And then it came to mean the teachings. So dharma can mean, it has 10 or 12 different classical meanings, but the most important one is thing, existing object. Okay? And then it came to mean the teachings of Lord Buddha. Okay? To understand how long the teachers are going to stay around, you have to understand the two kinds of dharmas. And this comes from the end of the Abhidhamma Kosha. Okay. First one. Lung, as you know, those of you who've been around Buddhism for a while, like a lama gave a lung or an oral transmission, and another version of this word, lung, means air or breath, prana, and so lung means literally the words, or the, yeah, you can say the physical dharma, okay, lung means the physical dharma. It means books about dharma, tapes about dharma, CD-ROMs about dharma, teachings themselves, okay? The physical teachings as they exist in the world, okay? By the way, we're going to get tomorrow to a part, or the next day, of this subject that says, this is the holiest subject in the world. The pen thing is the holiest subject in the world. Anybody who understands that correctly could actually use Tantra to become a god or goddess in this lifetime, you know, an enlightened being in this lifetime. So the closer you get to this information, the harder it gets and the more problems you have. It's like good guys in the middle of Bihar, okay? And the closer you get, the harder it gets to be here. So I mean, physically, and it's true, this is, physically, the closer you get, the harder it should be to get to the next mile. Mile by mile, each mile you get closer to Vajrasana, the seat of the diamond, it should get harder. And you should have more problems. And that's just physically. But if you think about the idea of emptiness, you know, the pen thing, to have a really good explanation about it, to get close to that, to get exposed to it, is more and more expensive karmically. You see what I mean? And the diamond cutter says the closer you get, the more problems you'll have. Physical sickness and car accidents and trouble and disruptions in the class or in the Dharma group. The closer you get to the truth, the harder things get karmically. Okay, so those of you, we're going to cover that, I think, tomorrow. And it comes from the Diamond Cutter Sutra. So those of you who got coughs or sick, be proud. You know, it means that, no, they say the closer you get, if you're having a physically tough time, you're getting closer and closer. And they said, be happy. You know, be happy about it. Okay? You'll get better when you get back to America or Europe and have all those TV sets and movies and chocolates. Okay? Then you'll be fine, right? That's just fine. Okay, so Lingyichi means the physical dharma. Yeah. Namgyal Dukha Dwe. you have to meet, where's Toby? Oh, yeah, yeah, you guys have to go over there. Sure, sure, sure. Toby. Yeah, sit with them. You guys have a... Panidona. He's gonna help Pumundi. Alright, say Dr. Chen. Dr. Chen. Dogma means the realizations, the ideas, okay? And Chen means Dharma. So these are the actual living it, knowing it, okay? That's the Dharma in the minds of people. This is the Dharma in the books. This is the Dharma in the minds of people, okay? Dogma two boils down to three kinds of behavior. First one is morality, which is really just that list of things that make you turn into Manjushri faster. Second one is meditation. And the third one is wisdom. And in a special form, an advanced form called the three trainings. But these are, as long as there are people in the world who are acting kindly towards others and not harming others, as long as there are people who know how to meditate, as long as there are people who understand the pen thing, then you can say that this Dharma is still in the world. You see what I mean? The realizations. As long as there are people who are keeping their book because they understand that it will turn their arm into Manjushri's arm, right? And who are able to meditate, because you've got to meditate to see emptiness directly. I'm describing emptiness as an intellectual practice that you do from hour to hour. How to use emptiness when you give Rob a pen. You see what I mean? Tomorrow evening we'll get into the other kind of seeing emptiness, which is direct, extraordinary, powerful, 20-minute transformation of your life forever. Okay? You can think of your mind as a spaghetti noodle stretching through the universe infinitely on both ends. And it is. It has no beginning and no end. It continues on after you get enlightened. And there's one dot on the spaghetti noodle called the 20 minutes that he or she saw emptiness directly. And after that, you're just a totally different being. You're not the same at all. You are 100% totally transformed being. You cannot go back. You will always be a different being. Totally higher, completely different being. I think of it as losing your virginity or something like that. You can't go back. You know what I mean? There's a first time. You know what I mean? No, it's exactly the same thing. In your lifetime, physical human lifetime, there's a point, there's the first time. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing. You see emptiness once, you're changed forever. You're a totally different class of being. You're higher, you're on a higher level forever. You know? And it's one point of 20 minutes on a line which is billions of years long. You see what I mean? And that's the idea, is to get there. To get there, you have to know how to meditate. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. So these are the three. As long as anyone is watching their vows, you know, keeping the 10 good deeds, meditating and understanding this thing about pens and karma and future lives and things like that, then we can say that this Dharma is still in the world. Okay? Now, there'll come a time after that, says Vasubandhu in the Abhidhamma Kosha, Master Vasubandhu, and he says, there'll come a time after that when it's just the books are laying around libraries, you know? And you see that sometimes you go to a library, I'm afraid sometimes in India, you know? I go to a holy place, you know, and they say, here's the stupa, here's the temple, here's where Lord Buddha did this. And then there's always this cement place, and then there's a big hallway, and then there's a cabinet, a locked cabinet, and it's got 14 Dharma books in it with dust on them, and no one ever looks at them, you know what I mean? And that's just Nindicha is left there. There's nobody teaching, there's nobody like actively practicing those things. It's just this, I think of it as a lock case in a library and these books gathering dust behind glass, and you can see them, and the Dharma is reduced to that. There's nobody who cares, nobody who's read those books, you know, and so you can say that the Dharma chain will die out first. You see what I mean? All the people who practice well will go to their own Buddha paradises. Go? Okay? all the other rest of the schmucks will be left here, and then the books will just be, you know, CD-ROMs laying around with no one to know how to turn them on or something. You know what I mean? And that'll be the end of the... Then when there's no more even books laying around, then that's the end of the physical Dharma. Okay? No more tape recordings. His Holiness's tape recordings are sitting in Dharamsala Library right now. Thousands of them. You know, rotting. They don't have the money to take care of them. Can't play them, half of them anymore. And that's like, I always imagined that. You know, here's these tapes sitting there, physically rotting, you know. And that's the, that would be the end of the physical Dharma, okay? And that's the, that's what belongs to, that's what it means, okay? As long as, technically, here's the technical definition, okay? As long as anyone is practicing these three things, in an honest way, trying, then the ideas, Dharma in people's hearts, it still exists in the world. And then later there'll come a time when it dies out, that there's even no one to teach it, you see what I mean? There's no one around who can correctly and with the right motivation, okay? Which means it could still exist in a university somewhere, but I'm talking, you know, with the desire that people use it to reach enlightenment, then that'll be the end of this Dharma. So this Dharma ends when there's no one around to teach it honestly, purely, with a good motivation, correctly. And this Dharma ends when there's no one left alive who has those realizations in their mind, okay, of those things. Those are the way that the Dharma is going to end. Okay, now we'll get into numbers, okay. I'm going to give you like 8 different sources on how long the Buddhist teachings are going to last. You only need 3 of them for your homework, so you can skip the last 5. All right. This is called Dodikyalsang. I'm not going to write all the Tibetan. It's in the Kangya. We have it in Tibetan. And it says that for 500 years after the Buddha passes, the Dharma will exist in a pure form, in a good form, strong. And then for another 1500 years, it'll continue as sort of a shadow of its former self. Okay? Sort of, not very strong. Which equals 2000 years. Then there's the story of finger rosary. Okay. In Sanskrit it's called Angulimala. In Tibetan it's called Sorcheng. This is a person who had a bad guru in an ancient India in the time of the Buddha, and that guru told him, you kill people and cut off, I think it was like one finger for each person, and then wear it around your neck on a string. And when you get to 1000 you'll reach nirvana. Okay? And so he started, and he killed 999 people. Now, who are we running to for number 1000? It's Lord Buddha. You can go to Shravasti in Uttar Pradesh, and they have the places there. It's beautiful. And he went into Lord Buddha. So Lord Buddha's walking down through this garden, and Angulimala is running after him, and he can't catch up to him. Lord Buddha says, come on, you can... I don't mind to be number 1000, you can kill me. And he says, well, stop moving, you know. He says, I'm not moving. He says, yeah, you are, you're running, you know. And he says, I'm not, I'm standing still, you know. He says, but in Angulimala's perception, see, the Buddha's like running always about a foot ahead of him. And he's like trying to kill him, you know. Anyway, the place is there, and then he finally said, look, you must be somebody special, because I can't catch you. And then he said, okay, here's how to get enlightened. It's not by cutting people's fingers off. And then Angulimala became a great monk and a great arhat, okay? And his house is still there. The walls of his house are still there, next to the, right close to where the Buddha taught the diamond cutter, okay? So in that Avadana, in that scripture, it says 1,000 years. There's a scripture called Dawe Nimo, the essence of the moon. And it's actually a person's name. And he's a bodhisattva who requested a teaching from Lord Buddha. And in that sutra, it says 2,000 years. called Dodepekar, the Pundarika Sutra, which is the Lotus Sutra, and in there it says 1,500 years. In the Abhidharma, the auto commentary by Master Vasta Bandhu himself, okay? So you can say Abhidharma, auto commentary, okay? 1,000 years. It comes from a Vinaya scripture called the Tensing, which is one of the four great original scriptures on Vinaya, okay? You only got two choices. Like, no, we're talking ancient India. Yeah, it happens to be Kamalashila, Master Kamalashila, okay? And in there he says 2,500 years. When he gets to this part. I'll give you one more. There's a commentary to the 100,000. This is one of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in 100,000 verses, and we still have it in Tibetan. It's called Bum in Tibetan. There's a debate about who wrote it, but it's called Bumtik. And in there it says 5,000 years. Okay. And Chandragupta Sidhu discusses all these positions, and he comes out with some interesting things. He says, the shortest periods, like people who said 1,000 years, were trying to make people depressed. Okay? Like they're trying to get you to move, you know? Like probably especially people who lived around 900 years after. You see what I mean? And they were trying to say, look, there's not much time left. You have to work hard. You know, and you should study, you should meditate. This stuff's not going to be around shortly. Okay, and he decides that these are to be interpreted, right? These are figuratively meant. And then he says maybe some of them, I think, refer to the pure teaching in India itself, which died out about 1,000 years after the Buddha lived. Okay, so he says I'll explain it that way. Also, if we have time, I'll go through another presentation of it, but there are 10 periods of 500 years each in the Buddhist teaching. There are 10 eras of the Buddhist teaching, and each one lasts for 500 years. The first three are times when people are achieving extraordinary levels, like seeing emptiness directly on a very common basis. I mean, people all the time are seeing emptiness directly and things like that. That refers to the early groups of 500 years. Okay, so he explains it that way. Then he gets into his own position, which is the 5,000. Okay, he says the 5,000 is correct because many scriptures talk about groups of 500 years each. And even the Diamond Cutter Sutra said when Subhuti asks the question, will this stuff last? Or will there be anybody who gets it? Then Lord Buddha says, in the last 500-year period, there will still be people, even in that lousy time, there will be people who get it. So don't ask stupid questions, Subhuti. He's very tough on him, okay? So then we get to this periods of 500 years each, okay? I'll just do them real quick. You ready? The 10 groups of 500 years are divided into three bigger groups. Okay, the first group is called the era of spiritual results. Okay, in the first 500 years, which is, I'm going to put one like this, okay? There are lots of people becoming arhats. So I guess you could say it's 500 BC to 400 BC, right? Oh, sorry, to 0 BC. How about to 0? Okay. 500 BC to Christ, right? You could say during that time, lots of people are achieving arhat. Now, when I first sat in the library in Dharamsala, and they were throwing around arhat, arhat, and arya, and arwa, awa, and I was like, what's the difference, you know? Arhat is anybody achieving nirvana, okay? They call Dhatrama in Tibetan, destroyer of the enemy, okay? And that just means anybody who has stopped their jealousy, anger, desire, you know, pride, forever. That's nirvana. Because they saw emptiness directly. And specifically because of all the ideas they had on that day after they saw emptiness directly. Which, those ideas are all grouped together and called... Okay, yeah, nobody's saying noble truths. Nothing. They are noble, but so is all the other parts of Buddhism. It's the Arya truths, meaning Arya... I think that's the next one, let me see. No, that's the third one. Let's do the third one. Lots of Aryas, okay, in the third group. Meaning lots of people see emptiness directly, okay. The way it is nowadays, at its current level, which doesn't have to stay that way, if there were one person in the world who had seen emptiness directly alive today, it would be good times, okay. All right, but we've changed that. Okay, but right now that's the way it is. So in those days, it's very, very common. Okay, there are lots of people who have seen emptiness directly, and people are doing it all the time. Okay, so Arya just means somebody who's seen emptiness directly. The word Arya, which Hitler misused so badly, does mean a different kind of being. You know, they're on this side of the spaghetti noodle, okay? Like, they are totally different. You know, they're extreme emperor. They know when they're going to be enlightened. They've seen their own enlightenment directly. So they're on their way out. They're called stream enter, okay? They've made it, okay? So somebody between here, called non-returner. So somebody asks you there's a difference between arhat and arya, you'd say, okay? Which means in the monastery, when you want to debate this kind of thing, you say, are there three or four possible combinations between arya and arhat? Shaggy made an answer. Nobody could show me those combinations. You do it. Bhagavan says, what the hell? That's not right. Yeah. So there are like three or four combinations between the two. I want to know somebody who's an arhat, but not an arya. It's giving an arya, arhat is not an arya. Yeah, make an answer, okay? Make an answer. No such thing, okay? If you want to get to the point of nirvana, you must be a person who's seen emptiness directly. So there's no mu. Mu means possible combination. There's no such thing as a person who's an arya, arhat, who's not already an arya. Got it? There's no such thing as a person who reached nirvana because of what they saw when they saw emptiness, who hasn't seen emptiness. Okay? Now, So is there such a thing as an arya who hasn't gotten to arhat yet? But still has a mental affliction. How's that? Somebody who's seen emptiness directly but still has a mental affliction. Okay? Because, very typically, to move from here to here is 7 lifetimes. Okay? If there's any ayahs in the world today who became an ayah in this lifetime, they probably, typically, would have 7 lifetimes to go. And they know it. And they know what's going to happen generally in their life. They know their general condition, how it's going to be, and it's going to be cool. Everything cool. For 7 lifetimes, then enlightened. Okay, so... So there is such a being. Now, how about... Is there such a thing as someone who's neither? Okay. Is this new as someone who's boss? We got in the new shop. Someone who's in the IHOP and I. Yeah, she said in the IHOP. That's okay.
All right.
That's a lazy answer, but that's okay. All right. That's how you would decide a question like that in the monastery. You say, give me the four permutations, or three or four permutations, okay? Anyway, that's called the error of spiritual results. Oh, non-intuitive means doesn't have to come out to the desire realm. What's the desire realm? The thing called samsara, which is any place you are where things don't work right, okay, is divided into three parts. Form realm, formless realm, desire realm. We are in the desire realm. Why? Why is it called the desire realm? First Dalai Lama in his Abhidhamma commentary says, this is called the desire realm because people only think about food and sex. Okay? And that's why it's called the desire realm. Okay? That's the two main concerns of almost everybody in this particular realm. Okay? Then there's the form realm, which you can't see if you are who you seem to be. And in that realm, people, things are a little better. They live like deities. Okay? Temporary happy place. Due to intense periods of meditation in a desire realm rebirth previously, normally, okay? Like, if you meditated a lot, but you just spaced out during that meditation, you might get to the form realm, okay? And then that's like a result of like just watching your breath for your whole life or something like that. You get to move up into another broken realm, okay? Why do you get to move up? It's very simple. It's by a process of, what do you call it? Default. You don't have any chance to lie, steal, cheat, kill, sexual misconduct. Okay? Why? You're meditating all the time. It's called something yidomba. It's called the vow that comes from the self-restraint born of meditation. Meaning, you're sitting there on a seat with your mouth shut, you can't commit too much bad karma. Okay? And so you get to go out. Okay? And if you sit there all your life and just space out, it's called means if you meditate and just watch your mind float around, just watch your breaths for the whole period, okay, just try to think about nothing, then you get to be born into the form realm, okay? Then you normally go to a hell realm right after that, okay? Really, seriously, because you use up all that karma by being there and you don't have any other karma. So that's actually a very, very dangerous thing to do for your whole life. It's Vasubandhu and other scriptures say at the beginning, Master Vasubandhu, watch your breath for a few minutes, 5-10 minutes to get into meditation, and then move to a meaningful object, move to something important, virtuous, you know, something that'll get you somewhere, okay? But don't just space out and sit there and just try to be calm, okay? While you're getting older and dying, you know, that's not the thing, okay? So, you are in a thing called the desire realm. You can't see the other realms. The day you see emptiness directly, you will. Okay? Like this whole thing about desire realm, form realm, formless realm doesn't mean anything to you until the day you see emptiness directly. Then you see where you are. For the first time, you understand that there are other realms. Okay? It's like really exciting to realize, to really see them and understand that there are such things. Okay? I don't mean to say that you see hell realms or you see deities sitting around on their clouds or something like that. I don't mean that. I mean, you have a direct perception that you are in a separate realm called the desire realm and that there are other realms, okay? And you have that. So that's non-returner means after you've seen emptiness directly, if you're able to eliminate a number of your mental afflictions in their grosser forms, you can get to a point where you only have to come back to this particular screwed-up realm one more time, okay? And that's called non-returner, okay? Wisdom, meaning the training of wisdom. Now that's a technical thing, it's called the extraordinary training of wisdom. It's not quite normal wisdom, it's not just wisdom, but let's call it wisdom for now. What it means is that in those days, but we have to date these things, right? This is 0 to 500 AD. This is 500 to 1000. This is 1,000 to 1,500. Lots of people will understand wisdom, practice it, read about it, study it, okay? Meditation. This one means there'll be people who are meditating and still keeping their book, but who don't get the pen thing. Okay. All right. That'll die out. Somebody standing up and waving a pen around for 2 hours will die out. And then they'll just be people who are, you know, honestly and sincerely trying to meditate and practice not harming other beings. But they, when you get into the pen thing, they blank out. Okay. Yeah, we're right out there. Okay. We're about to lose meditation. Okay. Okay, and third one would be morality. Like, there are still basic morality. People in countries, still the hero of the movies is the guy who does the right thing. Okay? But when you say meditation, would you like to come for an hour and meditate? They're like, I want to eat breakfast, you know. Okay. And then that'll be the time that that meditation is dying out. The people who really know how to meditate, which we'll talk about tomorrow evening, okay, that's dying out. But still people have this basic morality. They still think it's bad to kill other people, and they still think it's wrong to steal things from other people and things like that. Okay. Can you still see that? If I write down here, can you still see? Yeah. It's okay. If I don't stand in front of it. Okay. All right. This is called the era of the physical Dharma. So era number seven, period number seven of 500 years, the Abhidharma teachings will still be around. Okay. Now, Abhidharma means a million different things. People who were in Kathmandu, we studied it a little bit. But in this context, it's referring to one of the three baskets or collections of scripture, what they call the Tripitaka. Okay. This is one of the three groups of the early collection of scriptures. And they mostly, the reason they're grouped together as Abhidharma is they treat wisdom. Okay? Their primary subject is wisdom. Okay? So they took all the books that mainly talked about wisdom and put them into a collection called Abhidharma. Okay? When we talk about Abhidharma Kosha, that's a different thing. Okay? That's a whole different thing. Okay? As one of the five great subjects, okay? It's talking about something else, okay? Okay, number eight is called Sutra, or books on that mainly talk about how to meditate, concentrate. Okay, so we're not talking. Sutra means a short book, okay? Normally spoken by Lord Buddha, but there are lots of sutras that weren't spoken by Lord Buddha. And sometimes it means open teachings as opposed to secret teachings. But in this case, it means the basket or the collection of books whose main subject is meditation. Okay. When you talk about the three baskets, you're talking about main subject. Okay. So this is going to, the books about and the teachings and the tapes about wisdom will last up to 3,000. Okay. But nobody will be practicing it very well. You see what I mean? They'll still be transmitting it in a sincere way. But nobody will be really achieving the goals of that or practicing it very well. Okay. Dhamma Sutra lasts up to 3500 AD. You know, if you know this, you can like hedge on the year 2000 problems and stuff like that. You know the world's not going to end. Anyway, sutra books. And then finally, what we call Vinaya, which is books on, how do you say, morality. And they'll last up to 4,000. Then there's this sort of shadow period called the era of just a trace. The era of just a trace. And that's 500 more years. And the Dharma is just, that's period number 10, okay? It's called just a trace of its former self. And like there's a few books around, and there's a few people around teaching, there's nobody practicing very hard, no one reaching any results, and the Dharma is just a shadow of its former self. Okay. One of the reasons I like to teach these 10 groups of 500 years, and by the way, the 10th one is the period that Subhuti was asking the question about, so it seems to me to be a reasonable question. Sandy, in the last 500 year period, 5,000 years from now, in Shravasti, you know, will there be anybody who still gets all this? And Lord Buddha gets mad and says, of course there'll be high bodhisattvas who actually seen emptiness and things like that come and teach people about those things, okay? So, even in the 10th period. Now, the reason, one of the reasons to talk about this that I like is something big is supposed to happen right here. Okay? And I'm not kidding, okay? There's a sutra called the, we'll talk about it, but it's called the Chimir Hamo. And it says that something big is going to happen right here, right there. It specifies right there about the Dharma. So, kind of like it, that's like a commercial, you know? So, have a break, take your 10 minutes, you know? And then, no, really. And relax, okay? And then when we come back, we'll cover that, okay? Okay. Okay, it's a long one. You know, this is like the holiest, one of the holiest lines in scripture, so I'm going to put the whole thing up here, all right? Sorry. Okay. I'll get out of the way in a minute. Okay. You okay, Ellie? Okay. Lots of purification in this room. Okay. Yes, please.
Isn't it like LHA?
Yeah, it's a good question. The pronunciation is HLA, Hala. Okay? And people who wrote the name of Lhasa, for example, blew it. Okay? When you write it in Tibetan, you write the L first and the H later, but the pronunciation is the other way around. Okay? Hla. So you have to be careful to distinguish between pronunciation and transcription. You know, writing it, all the sounds and writing all the letters in English characters, and then the actual sound. You have to, a lot of times in Tibetan, people make a mistake between the, they put the transcription for the sound. You see what I mean? And that's very common. Like Lama Sopa's name is a mistake. The Z is a mistake, okay? It's just they mistook the transcription for the sound. The sound is an S sound. You see what I mean? Things like that. And those of you who are studying Tibetan, you have to be trained to distinguish between the transcription and the sound. Okay? Okay, I told you, like, I heard about this prediction, and Tony Dabashudu discusses it in another commentary that he wrote on the Abhidharma, and it's a description about, it's a long explanation about it, but it's basically that Hlamo means goddess, okay? Like an emanation or a goddess, okay? Tima Mepa means Vimala, means immaculate. And the actual, her full name is Flawless Light, okay? She's the goddess named Flawless Light. And she requested a sutra of Lord Buddha. So the sutra was named the goddess of flawlessness, okay? Or Flawless Light. Okay. Mepa means without flaw, okay? Shuva means she requested it. And that's the name of the sutra. Sutras are often named by the person who requested it. So this sutra, which was requested by the goddess of flawless light, and the light's not in here, okay? This is her nickname, all right? Says, okay, lay means, it's a, in that scripture you can find, and this is a paraphrase of it by Chani Dabashiva. Long means years. Nyitan Rakya means 2,500. Na means after. Here it means after. Dong Mao Tsen literally means red-faced people, but what it means is it means people of lighter complexion who get red when they get cold or like that. Okay, I mean, it means the people of lighter complexion, meaning Western, the people in Western lands. He explains it as people in Western lands. The people with ruddy white-faced people, okay? Mai Chengi, Yudi means to their countries. Dhamcha Dharma means the holy Dharma will spread, like big time, okay? And it's very cool. So if you time it, this is the year. Something like, I mean, I don't know, 4 years ago or something like that. I think it's like I don't know what it is, but I think 1956 or so. I don't know when it was they decided it was 2,000 years. But it's right around now, right around the time that the first Tibetan lamas like Lama Yeshe started to come to the United States and other Western countries big time. Marx, according to Lord Buddha's prediction, right, in this sutra, the beginning of the passage of the Dharma into the Western countries, you know? And I think that's really cool. And I don't believe these things unless I see them written down in scripture. I went and checked it and it says that. What's it got to do with us? The way I like to think of people as like tennis balls, okay? Like, you know, and there's two people, okay? And they have this outer skin with all the fuzz on it, and then there's rubber under here, and then this whole inside is empty. And I think of the topicha, the ideas are living in this person's mind, you know? Like, this person has the ideas in their mind, and then they have a skin on, you know, they're in a body. So the mind is there, and, you know, this is just a way to visualize it. And there's this skin there. And then here's this other person who doesn't have those ideas yet, okay? And then this skin here, to me, is like the, what do you call it, the lungicha, the Dharma, physical Dharma. You see, I mean, like, somebody has these ideas in their mind. Somebody has seen emptiness directly, okay? And that exists in their mind. And then they have to move something for you to get it. You see, I mean, they have to talk, or they have to wave their arms around, or hold up a pen or something. They have to, the outside of the person has to do something, you know, and they have to say something. And then all the stuff that's inside of them will be transmitted to the other person. It's like breaking through a hole, you see what I mean? And then all this stuff leaks out into the other person's mind, you see what I mean? And this is the physical Dharma, and this is the mental Dharma in people's hearts. And that's what you guys have to do now. You by coming to this class, you now have a responsibility. You know, you have to pass it on to the next person. You see what I mean? You have to be the next tennis ball. You see what I mean? Now it's your problem. I'm going into 3-year retreat. You see? Now it's actually your responsibility to pass on to the next link in the chain. You see what I mean? And it's a very interesting thing that's going on nowadays. The Dharma is shifting to the Western Hemisphere. You know what I mean? The Dharma is moving to a new place. And it's a perfect time. The situation, the conditions are perfect, you know? In America, for example, and when I say America, it's because I've been teaching in New York so long, but you can say Australia or Europe or whatever. You have a huge population. You don't have enough time to practice Dharma. And you have, they're very well educated. In terms of history, in the history of mankind, these people are very highly educated. They didn't have to be out working in the fields all day. They had time to go to school. Whether you liked your school and your university or not is not the question. You are well educated, you know. You can sit here, you can write everything, you can learn everything. And the other neat thing about America especially, there's no religion there at all. You know what I mean? To speak of. You know what I mean? There's not, like when I taught in Ireland, it was difficult because people were already they had a strong ideas about religion, and in fact, in the end, it made them better, you know? They were able to catch everything immediately in the terms of their own Catholicism, but they did it big time, very nice, you know? But in many of the Western countries, and I'm talking about myself, we didn't have much, you know, it's not like there's a strong religious tradition where you have to do something and you have to go to church and you have to follow this. They don't hang you anymore, they don't burn you anymore if you don't follow it. You say, I'm into Buddhism, they say, that's cool. You know, and nobody cares much. Because there's a big vacuum. What I'm saying is like, the Western countries are like a big vacuum. There's not much there. And then there's all this incredible Dharma, and there's these people who are intelligent, and they want it, you see what I mean, in a way that they, it's a human need, like food. The Abhidharma says you need three things to survive. You need physical food, you need concentration, and you need sleep. And there's another one, which is hope, you see? I mean, but you need to have some kind of spiritual life. People are not happy for more than 4 or 5 years or something without any spiritual life at all. People hunger for it. I went to Russia right after communism collapsed, and there was this incredible hunger for some kind of principles, some kind of way to live your life. It hasn't been filled yet. You see, I mean, you still go to Russia, you go on the subway, there are 50 books on the subway being read, everything from, you know, New Age up to, you know, Third Eye Joe, you know, and really, every Russian is sitting there reading something. They hunger. People need it like food. People need to know why their mother died. You know, they need to have a decent answer of why there's AIDS and cancer and kids being burned in cars and, you know, what's going on, you know, and people have a deep desire, like they need it like food, you know. So it's like a perfect time in the Western countries that people really want it. People really need it. So, and it's there, you know, like all the things in the Diamond Cutter and every other Buddhist scripture are true. You know, all that stuff that you ever heard about is actually true. You know, I mean, when you see emptiness directly, on that day, you realize that 200,000 books of Buddhist scripture, all those wild things described in there, are 100% true. You know what I mean? And you freak out. You know, you get fanatical about saving those books. You must save those books because they're all true. You see, all that wild stuff in all those books, this is just a few pages you're studying for a week, you know. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages is all true, you know. And it's just going to be this big movement into Western country. Now, what's it going to be like? You know, are we going to build all these churches and go from door to door with our diamond cutters? And, you know, bang and say, you gotta read this, you know, this will save your life, you know, and, okay, we're not allowed to do that, okay, in Buddhism, you're not allowed to do that, you're not allowed to bother other people with your religion, okay, that's why, technically, a lama can't teach until you offer a mandala, and in other situations, they're not allowed to say they know what you want until you ask them 3 times, you see what I mean? It's a rule in Buddhism. They have to come to you 3 times respectfully, properly, with a good heart and with a good motivation, and ask you 3 times. You're supposed to refuse the first 2 times. You say, and then the 3rd time you say, "Well, I don't know anything, but let's do it." You know. And so how is it going to spread? You know, or are we going to go and build physical dharma? You see, are you going to go to the Western countries and build a lot of buildings and make a lot of, you know, that's not the main thing. You know what I mean? People ask me, where's your center in New York? I say, we don't have any. And people say, well, can I call you? I say, no, because there's nobody answering the phone, you know? And, you know, they say, well, you know, like, I don't have a place to stay in New York City. You know what I mean? Like, we just... It's just dopeture, you see what I mean? It's just the ideas are spreading around, you see what I mean? And my, the way I think about it is that you have to concentrate on the ideas, you see? Spread the ideas to other people. Be the next link in the lineage by passing on the ideas, you see? The physical stuff will come later, you know what I mean? Once there's 500 people who've seen emptiness, they'll probably build something, you know what I mean? To stay there, or something like that. But in the meantime, it's not the main thing. You know, so many centers are... This is my personal feeling, okay? So many people are investing in something that's expensive, and then the whole effort of the people there is spent paying the rent, building, you know, trying to scrape up the money, doing things you really don't want to do, meaning like trying to sell Dharma stuff or, you know, trying to kind of twist people's arms or stuff like that, to raise money and having to go to work maybe more than you want to go to work because you got to pay the rent for the center or something like that. I'm not saying that it's wrong to do that. I'm not saying that it's wrong to build centers and things like that. I'm saying let's do it the other way around. You know, spread the ideas first. Put your money and your time into your own practice, and then put your time into talking to other people and studying with other people. And you can do that in your living room. You see what I mean? Maybe it's better to do it in living rooms. You see what I mean? Maybe get the diamond cutter, that book and start in your living room with three or four people and listen to tapes or watch the audio, the video, and talk about it with each other and start it that way. See, I mean, that's to me a transmission of the Dharma. And then when you get up to like 30, 40 people who are very serious, then you're going to need to find a place to do it in. And then you can rent a school on Second Avenue. We just rent a school. We don't pay any rent. We don't have any place, okay? We just, this is a stupid little elementary school, and it's cheap. See, the point is the knowledge has to pass on first. You see, I mean, the realizations have to be created in people's minds. The other stuff will come later. But don't tie yourself down. Don't tie yourself down for 12 hours a day trying to earn the money to pay for a big place that before, and then at the expense of people's meditation or at the expense of people's practice or understanding or seeing emptiness or things like that. You see, that's what I'm trying to say. So you are, in my mind, you're the next generation. What I wanted to say is that there are people sitting here now. There's four or five people. They got this course in Bendigo, Australia, or they got this course in Ireland or Washington, D.C., or something like that. And they went home, and they invited a few people over, and they went through it again together. You see, in their living room, you know, once a week at night. And then they started teaching other people, and they started talking to other people. And now there's one case, a person is here. They just rented a place because they're up to 60 people, you see what I mean? And they're studying hardcore. Like, there are 28 courses like this you can take. We have the books are translated. It's just like this, and there's tapes, and 10 of them are meditation courses. And then you just get a hold of one of those. And the way we do it is, if you can afford it, you pay $50. If you can't afford it, we give it to you for free. And we're going bankrupt all the time. Last July, we stopped for a month. You know, 1,000 people took these courses last year, just at home. You see what I mean? And they started talking to each other, and there's a couple hundred prisoners doing it. And my vision or my idea of the way the Dharma spreads is, think about spreading the topicha. You see what I mean? Think about spreading the ideas. And it doesn't even have to be called Buddhism. I don't care. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that there's a statue on the altar or something like that. It doesn't matter. You see what I mean? If someone understands emptiness and undertakes to practice morality, to transform their own body and their own mind, then who cares if you call it Buddhism? You see what I mean? Like, you could sneak it into business books, or you could sneak it into novels, or movies, or stuff like that. You see what I mean? And that's the transmission of the Dharma. You see what I mean? I don't think Buddhism will spread in the Western countries through the Tibetan accoutrement. You know, I don't think that you'll have 10 million Americans wearing these suits around. You know, I mean, I treasure it and I understand it and I know what it stands for and I'll always keep it, but it's not going to spread that way in the Western countries. I think in the Western countries you're going to see the first true transmission of Dharma by lay people who know what they're talking about, who are very, very well educated in Buddhism, who are meditating really well, practicing really well, keeping their vows and know their 484 commitments, you know, and keeping it hour to hour really, really well. And I see this whole thing, you know, I think this prediction will be fulfilled by people like you. And I want you to stop thinking of yourselves as students. You know what I mean? You are the next chain in the transmission. There's a point at which you stop becoming a student and stop becoming a teacher. And the idea that because the person has a white face or came from a Western country that they can't teach Dharma or they're not worthy to teach Dharma or something like that, learn the stuff. There's 28 courses to get through. You know, learn it and then pass it on to other people. And if the Tibetans had had this complex, you know, oh, you can't teach Dharma unless you're from India, you know, we have to do our prayers in Sanskrit. You know, forget it. They didn't do that. The Kadampas, the early Tibetan lamas, they went to India. They were turned on. Half of them died on the way. They came back. They sat down in their living rooms, which were little caves and stuff. And I said, what did you get? They said, hey, I went to Kashmir. I got Abhidharma according to the Kashmiris, you know. And what did you get? You know, no, I went to West Bengal and came back with Serenimbas, you know, Majumika stuff. Oh, you teach me, I'll teach you. Cool. And then that's how Buddhism started in Tibet. It wasn't like these big monasteries and stuff like that. It wasn't like that. It was people like you in the living rooms talking about the ideas. You see, I mean, getting the ideas spread that way. And then later they build temples and monasteries and stuff like that. But I think you're going to see, I sense a very exciting thing. First time in the history of Buddhism that it moves into a country where the normal people are so well educated and intelligent and up to a, they have enough physical comforts that they'll be able to study perfectly and see emptiness and reach all these tantric goals in their lifetimes and spread it among each other. You see, I mean, I think it's going to happen like that. I don't see it as, you know, I don't see it especially at the beginning. Americans, I can tell you, are not going to live in a little building together in little cells and three guys in a room, and we tried it, you know. It's not going to happen. You know? I don't think so, right now. And I don't know if that's the way Lord Buddha did it either, you know. I think it's going to spread big time, especially in the ideas are going to spread and become part of Western culture. So, I mean, it's not like Tibetan way of dressing or Tibetan way of, you know, do you think that the Indian pandits had these symbols and horns? And they didn't, okay? I mean, as Buddhism moves to each country, it takes on its own forms. The Tibetans' 200,000 scriptures were written over a 700-year period after they absorbed Sanskrit Buddhism, you see what I mean? And then they started writing their own. And after Jetsun Kapa's time, or even before him, nobody wrote the Sanskrit anymore. You see what I mean? Somebody asked me, should we do our prayers in Tibetan or English? I said, I think Tibetan is good. I do all mine in Tibetan. But I think if you once in a while read the translation and do your prayers that way, you'll find that it's much more powerful for your mind because you understand it. You know, in a deep, deep way, it communicates to you. You get this emotions. You start crying at certain points, you know. But if it's in Tibetan, even if you know what it means, you don't have that kind of emotion about it. You see what I mean? And I think it's a natural thing that Buddhism will be translated into English. People like you will learn it well in a way that even Geshe, you know, there's people in New York who have finished 28 courses. They've been through all the questions that you get on your Geshe examination. They know them. There's like four people who have finished all of them. There are women for the first time in history, and they know it. I mean, if they were in Tibetan, they could pass it all, you know, and in a debate ground, they'd do fine. You know what I mean? And it'll spread like that. My vision is that normal people, not Buddhist scholars, ordained is good, not ordained is good, doesn't matter. You see what I mean? We'll learn it well, and then they'll spread it in living rooms. You see, I mean, later on we'll have nice temples and things like that, and that's important. I'm not saying it's not important. There's extraordinary virtue to that. But I'm saying at the beginning, put your time and your effort and what little money we have left after this trip. I don't know if it's broke already, but anyway. You know, put it into the spreading the ideas among people. Then you don't have to say Buddhism to anybody. I worked in this huge corporation for 15 years. I didn't tell. For the first 5 years, nobody knew I was a Buddhist. I ran the business by Bodhisattva principles. It now sells $125 million a year, period. We started with three guys. But I ran it strictly by Bodhisattva principles. You see what I mean? And I didn't tell anybody. It doesn't matter because they're all living by Bodhisattva principles now. You know what I mean? And they don't happen to know that it's Buddhism. So, you see what I mean? So I see the transmission going that way. I think it's going to be like that. It's not to say that these things are not valuable. These are infinitely valuable. And the Tibetan monasteries are infinitely precious. And they're beautiful. But I'm talking a Buddhism spreading as becoming part of our culture. The way that movies are part of our culture, or the way that novels or certain kinds of food. It'll just be those ideas are followed by everybody. You know, whether we call it Buddhism or not, it doesn't really matter, does it? If they get enlightened and they become Tara, I don't care what you call yourself. You know what I mean? So now it's your problem, okay? You have a transmission to do now. And there's people sitting here who pulled it off already. They went home, invited a few people over, you know, listened to tapes, saw some videos, and they started practicing really sweet, and it's going really, really well. And there's no expense, you know, no money involved. The classes are free. It's just a bunch of friends together. They don't have any rent to pay. They don't have anything to raise money for. You know what I mean? And Dharma should be free. Somebody asked me, why are you charging $30 for this class? I never charge for a class, okay? In New York, everything is free. I went bankrupt doing the classes in New York, okay? And, you know, Mongolia and stuff like that. 2,000 people, 500,000 people watching on TV, free. Everything's free. The places I go to teach, sometimes they have to charge for their own expenses, and they offered me a one plane ticket. But otherwise, I mean, it should be free, okay? I mean, that's a Dharma, just as a principle, it should be free. I think it's a good idea to have a charge to cover the expenses, but I think that if you're going to end up teaching Dharma to other people or spreading Dharma to other people, you have to believe in it enough to take responsibility for the expenses yourself, okay? If you have to pay the rent for the place, you pay it. If you have to pay for the books and the binders, you pay it. You know, I just turned over all the Dharma teachings in New York to like 12 teachers. I got them in a room. I said, there's something I didn't tell you about. Just how this whole thing is financed. It's not, you know. And you're going to find a place to teach, and you're going to have to go Xerox and stuff, and you're going to have to maybe go get a job and pay for it. And they're like, you know, I said, what do you think we've been doing for 7 years here? You know, how do you think this stuff comes in? Everybody gets free books in New York, you know. And you know, I think you should think about, if you believe in Dharma enough, you should make sure that it's spread for free. And if you've charged a cover charge to get into the bar, you know, at least make some exceptions for people who truly don't have the money. You know what I mean? And never turn back a person for lack of money. In the monasteries at Sarah, for example, no one ever charged a student. It's a very interesting system. Once you take a person as your student, you are required to pay their expenses. You know, I like that system. Okay, I think it's cool. You know, I studied for 25 years in Sarah. Nobody asked me for 1 cent. You know, not once. Okay, and they're starving. Two of my teachers got tuberculosis because they didn't have enough food. They wouldn't take my money. You know, so. So it should be free, okay? And to make it free, you're going to have to pay for it, okay? It should be like that, okay? Should spread it like that. And now you have to spread it in your own way, okay? You got a book, and you got to take good notes, because you'll find it's very embarrassing if you missed a session. All right? And do it that way, okay? All right.
Sucked on. nyam pa me pa yang gong nu gong du bel war sho gong ri wa we kor we jing kam dir pen dang de wa ma lu jung we ne chen re zig wang ten zin gyat so yi sha pe si te bar du ten